Got the staff issues.
Oh, fine, okay.
Call the Senate Tax Committee to order. Members, I guess I'm going to follow the agenda. And Senator Jensen. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm here to discuss Senate File 2370. This bill has to do with the location equity that was passed last year for school districts. This bill has made two stops already this year. We met in the Education Finance Committee and discussed how we got to where we were right now as far as providing authority for school boards to participate in a location equity, which included for the seven county metro areas, $424, and then for any school district that had over 2,000 average daily membership students, $212. The bill then went on to finance, and we took a look at it in the Finance Committee, and we had a good discussion around the title of the bill. But what this bill does, so I think we'll have some conversation about that today, too, in this committee. But what this bill does is it says that the authority of boards to participate in location equity should be available to all school districts across the state. So it removes the 2,000 student. And then what it says is you can take an optional up to the $424. So that provides flexibility to the school boards to be able to determine if this is something first that they want to participate in, so they have the authority to decide that, and then what is the dollar amount that they want to participate with. That is the basis of the bill. There are also some technical changes that we made to try to streamline the implementation process, and that those were recommendations made by the Department of Education. With that, I would stand for some questions.
And thank you, Senator Jensen, and just coincidentally, all five of last year's conferees are sitting at the table and have some familiarity with this, as this came into the conference committee discussion at the very end of the conference committee last year. And so do you have testifiers with you, or are
I have people available to answer questions.
Okay. Are there any questions of Senator Jensen before Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, actually it's a question of council. One of my school districts is contemplating a referendum this fall, and they had an issue with what statements need to be put on the ballot question with regard to an increase in taxes that would result if the ballot question passed. And there was an interaction between the two questions that were going to possibly be asked, and they wanted to make sure that if it did not result in an increase in taxes, that they didn't need to put that statement on the ballot question. I think I'm getting it. I think I'm getting the ins and outs of that right. And I know that those no ballot language is in this bill, but I wonder if the language that is in, particularly I think it's Section 2, allows them to proceed in that manner without putting the question there. And who's going to answer that? I want it from
Mr.
Council. I don't want it from Senator Jensen.
Mr. Arneson?
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding from the department and Dr. Melcher is that the technical language in Section 2 page.
Mr. Arneson, would you state your name so we have your name with your voice?
Bjorn Arneson, nonpartisan analyst for the Senate. My understanding, Mr. Chair and members, is that the technical language between lines on page 2, between lines 16 and 22, largely address that issue, Senator Rest.
I need to know if whether it's Mr. Chairman, whether it exactly does it.
The
Mr. Barnes, Arneson.
Mr. Chair, the issue, as Senator Russ describes, is that districts, because of this location equity subtraction, districts would have to put a number on the ballot that wasn't exactly representative of the dollar amount that the voters themselves were approving. The language at line 16 through 22 would ensure that whatever dollar amount was put on the ballot asking the voters to approve a referendum allowance was actually the referendum allowance that would exist net of any location equity subtraction that may exist.
And Mr. Arneson, is that a result of the changes that were made in the E-12 bill relating to the weighting of students?
Mr. Chair, no.
No? Senator S.
Okay. Once again, we have something that is, Mr. Chairman, on the record. It's on the tape. Okay? It's right on the tape, what he just testified to. Mr. Chairman, I have the A3 amendment.
Do we get the A3 amendment passed out? And Senator Rest, do you want to walk us through the A3?
It's a very simple amendment. It is. It does change the how this revenue stream is to be titled. And it really doesn't have anything to do with location equity. It is a local optional revenue now, and local optional, we've thrown that term around, and it is, I think, far more descriptive. It is not a bill that's come forward that, as it was last year, that was an attempt to, by a lot of suburban school districts, to acknowledge that they have higher cost of living and higher cost of providing education. And the Senate, as you know, did not agree to that. We thought that was not a proper place for that discussion to take place. Nevertheless, it became part of the conference agreement, and we didn't have any say-so on it. And the proposal itself was patently misrepresented to the Senate conferees. Nevertheless, it got into law, and Senator Jensen's bill is, quite fairly extending it. I understand that there are other school districts that have needs as well, but we need a term that reflects what this program is, and it is not location equity. It is a local option revenue. So I offer the A3 amendment in that spirit.
And Senator Rest, you're absolutely right, as we would be expanding this to availability to all the school districts.
Yes.
It would have nothing to do with the location of a school district. Senator Jensen, have you seen the A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I have seen it.
And are you supportive?
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Rest, for bringing it forward, because I think it does represent what this does and allows transparency for the taxpayer to understand what we're doing with this revenue stream.
Any questions, members? Seeing none, Senator Rest renews her motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Thank you, Senator Rest. There is one testifier, Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I do have a handout, if the page could help with that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, just for the chance to offer a few brief remarks. We think that Senator Jensen has a lot of excellent ideas in this bill. And thank you. I just thought I would offer a few clarifying remarks, though, too, and also want to start out, though, by thanking all of you for the tax bill that you passed last year. When a lot of the rhetoric after the session was about this was the education session. And when you look at what was contained in the omnibus education bill, full-day kindergarten, the early learning expansion, et cetera. And you combine it with what was in the tax bill, the great increase in equalization, the board-approved levy authority, the location equity change. It really was some of the most significant changes and reforms and investments in education that we've seen in a long time. So thank you for that great work you did last session. As you've referenced already, there were some significant changes in the tax bill. And because of that, I think there was some misperception or some misunderstanding of what actually was in the tax bill, because people are used to seeing some of those things in the education bill. And one of the areas, I think, where there was a lot of confusion was about the location equity revenue program that was established. And I think people thought it kind of came out of nowhere, that, you know, we hadn't seen this before. And actually, Mr. Chairman and members, it's an issue that had been discussed for probably two decades, had been included in several major education funding reform reports. Going all the way back, Governor Plenty had a task force that included a recommendation to establish a mechanism to recognize the higher labor costs. The PS Minnesota group, some of you are familiar with, research conducted by Hamline University, by the University of Minnesota Humphrey School, to name a few. So ultimately, what happened was the Education Funding Working Group, and that's, you see, we just copied the cover page of that working group that Governor Dayton and Commissioner Casellas appointed, came up with a comprehensive set of recommendations. And if you just flip the page, you'll see recommendation number 9 was to recognize the regional cost differences. And if you look at that, you'll see what was adopted in the tax bill almost follows exactly what the recommendation was that came out of that working group. And then the following couple pages are just the data that kind of make the case or shows why there was interest in recognizing that. And the final page, Mr. Chairman and members, shows the revenue distribution from the education provisions that were in the tax bill last year. So as you all know, there was really three major education provisions: the new $100 board-approved referendum authority, which, as the working group had recommended, was really necessary to help bring the bottom up, to help those districts that had not been able to pass the referendum. And that resulted in about $16.8 million in new revenue. The new location equity program resulted in $17.2 million. And then substantial property tax relief of over $17 million. And we think what came out was a very balanced bill. It treated districts equitably. In fact, out of the new revenue that was approved, about 25 out of the $33 million went to non-metro districts. But the metro districts received the majority of the equalization and the property tax relief. So, again, we think the work you did last year was great. It was very balanced. And we think Senator Jensen has some excellent ideas in this bill. And all we would ask is that at the end of the day, end of the session, whatever comes out of the tax bill or the education bill, that you have a balanced approach. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhnquist. And I just briefly would like to say that while this did, you know, was included in some the working group reports, it didn't pass out of the Senate or the House. It did come into the conference committee last year. There were some variances from the implementation by the department from what the discussion in the conference committee was. And so while we're not proposing to take anything away from any school district that has needs, we do think that because of some of the discrepancies between what we thought was the intent and what actually the implementation, it's better to let all school districts have access to this at this point. And then with the hope that there will be balance brought to the school funding through the legislative process. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jenkins, how will this particular piece of legislation interplay with the small schools levy?
Chair and Senator Nelson, this does not do anything to the small schools levy.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding was that school districts had a choice between location equity revenue and small schools levy. And I am assuming that with this, do we need clarification in our language that says that small schools can still continue to keep the small schools levy?
Senator Nelson, I think the small schools funding mechanism that you're referring to came about in 2011. I think Representative Fabian was the prime mover behind that. This is a separate and distinct funding from that, and maybe Mr. Arneson would be willing to say if there's any connection between the two. Mr. Arneson?
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Nelson, while there was a bill introduced this session that would have more closely linked location equity with a district's eligibility for small schools, this particular bill and the language in front of you makes no connection between the two. So in the end, districts that are eligible for small schools would in the same way as every other district, be eligible for location equity.
Thank you. That's what I needed to hear.
And I will remind myself that after the A3 amendment, this is now local option revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else, members? Anybody else want to testify on Senate File 2370 as amended? No other discussion, members? With that, the chair will lay 2370 as amended over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And evidently, Commissioner Clark Sieben has a time constraint, so we will move to Senator Reinert's bill. Senator Reinert?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I have Senate File 2503. This regards the Angel Investment Credit. Members, you may remember that the Department of Revenue did a report evaluating sort of the use and effectiveness of the Angel Investment Credit that we instituted a couple of years ago. And so this bill does a couple of things. First of all, there's an author's amendment, Mr. Chair, to clarify that we're going to be at the $15 million mark this year, not 15 plus 13. And so whenever it's convenient for you, I'd like to...
Let's put the A6. It's the A6 amendment, Senator Reinert.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A6 amendment.
Senator Reinert moves the A6 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinert.
So, members, the bill primarily does a couple of things. Number one, it continues the Angel Investment Credit. It would put it at an amount of $15 million through this year and then stay at that amount through tax year 2016. The bill then addresses a number of things that were brought up in the report that was conducted through the Department of Revenue. And the report found a couple of things. Number one, maybe in an overarching point, it found that the vast majority of the Angel Investor Credit went in the metro area and went to folks that were probably going to invest in these startup business anyways, principals, initial board of director members. And the report suggested that we take a look at that and see if we can't tighten that up and make it more effective. So what the bill before you does is it does not allow the initial founders or principals of a business or their immediate family to receive the credit. Now, to be clear, it does allow someone who is an angel investor, invests in a business, they can then later on join the board so that they can bring some experience and wisdom and guidance to a business. But the idea, members, is that if you're probably going to invest because you're a principal or you're the immediate family of a principal, that we're not looking to reward that behavior. What we're looking to do is to bring other money into these startup businesses. And I know I was on tax committee at the time, and I know others at this table were, and that was the intent of our conversation. The bill also provides some incentive to get the angel investor credits out into greater Minnesota. So 50% of the credits are set aside for greater Minnesota, as well as female-owned and minority-owned businesses. So right now, only 11% of the initial angel investor credits went outside the metropolitan area. So as I look at committee members that are not from the seven-county metro area, our community has only received 11% of those credits. Or another way to think of it is 89% of the credits went in just the metro area. So the bill would set aside half of the credits for Greater Minnesota and also female-owned and minority-owned businesses. Or another way to look at it is if you are not female and you live in the metro area, you still have access to half of the angel investor credits. And just to give you some perspective, right now, 27% of businesses in Minnesota are female-owned, 6.4% are minority-owned, and what we saw in the initial period with the angel investor credit was only 2% went to female-owned businesses and only 1% went to minority-owned businesses. So we're lagging behind where our actual numbers are in terms of business ownership in the state. There are no other changes to how the credit program would work, and we would have another report in a few years' time so we can see if these changes helped get the credits out into a little bit more diverse audience. So that's a summary of the bill, Mr. Chair. I know there are a couple testifiers.
And Senator Reinhart, just to for my own clarification, the kind of the minority-owned female rural amount of money, I mean, and technically it could still be split 90% metro, 10% rural, but it would require that a pretty large percentage of that would then be
minority-owned
and female-owned.
Correct.
And it could be somewhere where 40% would be rural. We just don't know that at this point. But the underserved populations are going to be some requirements that they would have preference in accessing this money.
You're correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Reinhart, I really think this is a good approach. I'm curious as to what happens if there's not the appetite in Greater Minnesota that minority or women-owned businesses would apply for this. Would the credit then, be funneled to areas or investors where it wouldn't necessarily be in Greater Minnesota so that all the credit is used? I have a concern with that. We run into the same problem with something that's called a bond allocation authority, where if you don't use it, you lose it, and it goes to entitlement users or big cities or whatever, because they can always use more than the state's allocation to start with, and so they are, when we call them an entitlement user, it's actually a restricted user. How do we ensure, and I haven't read your bill thoroughly, I'm sorry, how do we ensure that all the credit that will be available is used by responsible investors?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, thank you for the question. My understanding is the credit carries forward, but I would ask for staff clarification on that.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair and Senators, the credit does carry forward. However, there is not specific language in this bill as amended that would provide for carry forward of the set aside credits. So there's no language that would provide that credits not allocated in the set aside not be used for the whole state.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Pollack, does that mean they, if the credits aren't used in the set-aside, they would be available for the rest of the state? I mean, that's...
Madam Chair, in the current language... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, in the current language, yes, I believe how it would apply.
So if it's not used, it's not lost. That's what I think is a very important element in this program. Thank you.
Senator Irving.
Well, Mr. Chair, I also have similar concerns to Senator Rest. I'm hoping that the angel investor credit is encouraging innovation, and it's the innovation and the market that are driving the investment and not some set-asides. And certainly I'm not opposed to rural Minnesota having every access to those tax credits, but I think they do now. And so I'm wondering, have there been any that have been denied to Greater Minnesota businesses that have been looking to use those tax credits? And I'm wondering if we've been using them all. So do you have that information or one of your testifiers?
Well,
Senator Reiner.
Mr. Chair, and I think the Commissioner D can probably speak more specifically to that. The report didn't indicate that anyone had been denied. It just indicated where usage was. So that's a policy decision that the committee can make.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Ortman,
with more information about that, I just don't think it's necessary, and I think it's an unnecessary restriction. Maybe we're trying to send a message, but I think the more important message is we want people to invest here in Minnesota. That's the most important message. I don't want it to get lost in some other message.
Thank you.
And Senator Ortman, I don't think that, from my understanding, that we're putting any restrictions on that are going to mean that the money doesn't get utilized. We're just trying to highlight that the report indicates that there are segments of the state that probably could use a little boost up in accessing this. And if they aren't able to qualify, the money will be utilized some other way. The rural doesn't have a specific percentage, neither do the minority component. But we're just trying to highlight the needs in those areas.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, then, what are we accomplishing?
We are strengthening the angel investor credit and continuing it with $3 million more for another year.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with that. I agree with expanding the angel investor tax credits. I'm just not sure we're accomplishing anything by having a so-called set-aside that isn't really a set-aside at all.
We have three people that wish to testify, Commissioner, and then we'll do the other two later. Commissioner Clark-Steven.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good to see all of you. I'm here this morning on behalf of the Angel Tax Credit Program. The governor has recommended $15 million per year for the Angel Tax Credit Program. The legislature passed and deed launched the Angel Tax Credit Program in July of 2010 to encourage private investments in high technology startups in the state, particularly software, medical device, and biotechnology firms. Since this program started, the Angel Tax Credit Program has facilitated more than $212 million in investments to Minnesota startups since it was launched in July of 2010. Since its inception, the program has made 767 business certifications, as well as certifying 2,160 investors and 82 funds. And there is great demand for this program. Demand for credits has far outstripped the amount available every year since the program began in 2010. This year, all of the $12 million allocation was exhausted by the beginning of March, the fastest we've ever seen these credits go. And I'd like to take just a moment to talk about the businesses that are typically applying to this program. These are very early stage startups in our state, typically have one or two employees, are working on fundraising Series A capital, so anywhere from $300,000 up to $3 million. Many of them are working out of their garage, their basement, or an office space that's shared with other entrepreneurs. They're leveraging their personal networks, their family and friends' networks, their personal contacts in order to fundraise money into their businesses at this stage. These companies are pre-venture capital companies, so they're not yet, they're working on product development. They're not yet ready to present to a venture fund. They're reaching out to the individuals in their networks, their circles, to ask for investment dollars to try to get their business launched off the ground. This program is focused on high technology startups because these Minnesota is a leader in this area with the University of Minnesota, with Mayo Clinic, and many other Medtronic businesses in this area, as well as we see higher wages come from this industry. So I think that's just an important note to make. As the Senator mentioned, the Department of Revenue recently completed the study of the program, and it was conducted by the Economic Development Research Group. The program has attracted $212 million in private investments and supported an average of 512 jobs at Minnesota startup firms from 2010 to 2012. That number is expected to climb to an average of 635 jobs from 2013 to 2020, and the report also found that it supported 571 indirect jobs in 2013. So positions such as contract workers, consultants, agency staffers in that indirect category. And while those job numbers may not seem as high as some of our other programs at DEED, like the Minnesota Investment Fund or our new Minnesota Job Creation Fund, those programs are designed to support mid-sized companies, large companies, and major expansions. This program is about startups with companies of 1 to 2 employees. So if they double their employee count to 4, that's a major accomplishment. So I just wanted to provide that context. And Mr. Chair, at this point, if it's okay with you, I'd like to invite Justin from Recombinetics to come sure. And testify.
Sure. Mr. Okay. Oh, I'm not going to get this one right. Zanacco. And Commissioner, before we start with that testimony, you indicated that the need was for $15 million a year, and with the addition of these $3 million, that'll bring us to 15. Is that what you would be requesting?
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you. I'm not going to try again. Would you state your name for the tape, please?
Justin Zanacco from Recombinetics.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Senators. Recombinetics is a development stage company that accelerates livestock genetics in both biomedicine and agriculture, and we are a biotechnology company that has our start from the University of Minnesota. And we have used the Angel Tax Credit to great success. We've hit our lifetime cap already. We have, over the past 2 years, we raised a little over $8 million, and we continue to gain investment, gain support, and really gain support of the local community. And what we have been able to do is we have started from going from 3 people where basically we're investing funds, we're not bringing any money in, to now we've grown to 14 full-time employees. And we continue to leverage the support of the University of Minnesota and keep investing in the local community. So this is really a Minnesota-based company. And without the tax credit, it really would have been more difficult to get investment into the company. So when I hear about the stories about startup capital and getting capital into companies, that resonates a lot, especially with me and my experience and with the company. The other thing that we've done is we're in the Twin Cities based to our proximity of high technology, biotechnology, being close to the University of Minnesota. One of the things about trying to constrain based on geographic location is somewhat concerning just due to the fact that usually technology and biotech is supported usually by the universities. So there's a really good roots and really good foundation where that comes from. Currently, we are looking at expanding into Glencoe, Minnesota, and looking at infrastructure expansions. And this is due to now of the development stage of where we're at, which is manufacturing for the medical device industry, new products. The other thing that I would just like to say is that right now in biotech, unlike traditional startups where in the internet where you don't need a lot of capital, biotech unfortunately requires lots of capital, lots of time, lots of nurturing, but like any good investment, it takes time and development to get to that stage. And this program really has allowed our investors, friends, family, networks, to really come in. And our company has no VC money. It's all individuals, and of the $8 million, $7.5 million comes directly from Minnesotans. So this is really Minnesotan investment. And basically, we just want to share that, you know, our policy with economic development in greater Minnesota is really based on our proximity to animal genetics, our proximity to where we see the future going, and we want to stay in Minnesota and expand in Minnesota. And we've had other states like the state of Texas trying to recruit us, and we've resisted that urge because we see the value being here in Minnesota. And now we're looking for that expansion into the rural communities, but it has to be at the right time. It can't, for us, to try to put deadlines would be a mistake, in our opinion. And we're just very grateful for this program and to have this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to remind anybody that's watching that might have an idea for an economic development project that might access this. There's a lot of talk about high technology, a lot of talk about biotech, but in the body of the language, it says a qualified high technology field or research and developing or producing new proprietary technology for the use in fields of agriculture, tourism, forestry, mining, manufacturing, and transportation. So there are a lot of other potential business development that could access this money. I just don't want us to get lost in the fact that we're very proud of Medtronic and the Mayo and the U here, but there are a lot of other opportunities in Minnesota to add value to our economy that are permissible under this program.
Anything else, members? Senator Sanchin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to this 50-50, and although being from Greater Minnesota, I'd certainly love to see that distribution being as it is. If it's 11% now and 89%, rural 11%, rural 89% metro. I mean, I'm not sure how we change this. And as I go to line 6-11, it seems to me it says that at least half must be allocated to credits in Greater Minnesota. And so does that really mean if it must be, if $7.5 million of the $15 million must be in Greater Minnesota, which frankly I'd prefer, but if it doesn't work out that way, is the metro area then limited to just $7.5 million? And it seems like the answer to that was no, but I don't understand, given this language, why that isn't the case.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sengem, so the way the bill is constructed now is that half would go to Greater Minnesota or female-owned or minority-owned, and the female and minority-owned could be in the metro. If you follow on to line 6.14 and 6.15, that's where we get the language that says if they're not used there. So it's sort of a first crack. And okay. If they're not used there, then they can go anywhere. So we may yet, find, to Senator Ortman's point earlier, that's where the tax credits end up being used. But it at least gives a little bit of a preference for where we're seeing underutilization, which is Greater Minnesota, female-owned and minority-owned businesses.
Mr. Chair, just to follow
Senator
up.
Senator Sengem.
And maybe this is more for counsel. Is the term Greater Minnesota defined in statute?
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sengem, it's defined for purposes of this bill.
Okay.
In Section 1. And it's defined as the area of the state outside of the seven-county metro area.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, thanks. And Senator Reiner, Commissioner, I'm not a big fan of the program, a big fan of helping early-stage companies and so on, but I wonder if I couldn't find in the report anywhere about how much angel investment there was prior to this and how much there's been since this. I thought I was hearing like $100 million a year back in 2008, 2009. And I'm just curious how much there was then, how much there is now, and maybe we can't track that, but I guess that's what I was questioning.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the report found that 48% of surveyed investors would not have made their investment without the Angel Tax Credit Program. So I hope that helps answer the question. And it spurred $71.7 million in additional private investment.
and as self-reported?
Yes, as self-reported.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, do we have any way of knowing how much total angel investment there is in the state, regardless of the program, with the program and without the program? I mean, non-investors who don't benefit from it plus those who do benefit, do we know how much that is right now total in the state?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, that is a very difficult number to track, given we're talking about very early stage companies that are not public companies and investments that are happening, individual investments to a startup. There have been some studies done. Deloitte did a study, I believe, in 2012 on venture capital in Minnesota, which is the next stage up of financing. But that showed that during the recession, we lost about 50% of venture capital activity here in the state. So this is an area that's still rebounding since the recession. I do think that this is the one program that DEED has to support businesses in this stage of the business life cycle that are very early stage, seeking, have a concept, have an idea, need those additional investments in order to take their product to an investment firm or to a VC.
Senator Hartman.
Yes. For
Senator Marty.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I guess let me say one more thing about it. From my perspective, it's lousy tax policy. I remember when this was funded, first time we took away a $25 tax credit to about half the households in the state. And in effect, since we capped the most any couple could receive, any household could receive at $250,000, in effect, we'd be raising taxes on 10,000 small households to fund one fairly well-off household. But if it created all these new jobs and everything, I just am reading in the report about how, and it doesn't say how many, but some investors delayed their investment when the tax credit appropriation was exhausted before year end, and now you're saying it's exhausted in 2 months. In effect, if I were an angel investor and I can get 25% of my money just handed back to me, I'm going to wait till next January, in which case we may actually be having a negative impact on it. And I realize that, yes, you balance that against the positives, but when I'm reading the results, they say that it's estimated the program will not pay for itself in 10 years, state earning 61 cents for every dollar it foregoes. If you count something else, the estimated revenue from income earned on qualified investments, then it's slightly more cost-effective, or I'd say less cost-ineffective, with the benefit of 78 cents on the dollar. And it's not projected to pay for itself within 10 years. Extending beyond 10 years leaves open the possibility eventually it could. I guess that's what I'm reading the report on the program, and I don't know if Department of Revenue or anybody is here on it, but why should we be adding to it? I'm glad you're taking out the fact that half the money is going to relatives and family members, but why should we be persuaded that this is helping? I know Mr. Zinanko's company benefits from angel investors, and to you, they are angels. I mean, these folks aren't investing because they're angels. They're investing because it's high risk that they're investing in businesses like yours, but some of them pay off big for them. And when the state says, we're going to give you 25% of your money back, if we're doing this, wouldn't it be better to do a 5% credit or something, have it last the whole year? Can you speak to that anymore?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, I think we're doing this program because it's the one state-funded program that we have at the Department of Employment and Economic Development to support early-stage startups across our state. Without supporting innovation, entrepreneurs, new product development, we will have a huge gap in how we're supporting our future economy. We know that not every startup that receives an angel investment through this program is going to survive. We know that some of these startups are going to fail, but we know that there will be some that do survive that become the next Medtronic or 3M in our state. And I do strongly believe in this program. And if I would like to share just one idea from administering this program and your discussions around carve-out for Greater Minnesota and Senator Marty, your point from the report that shows that some investors were waiting until the next round of angel tax credit availability before they would invest in that startup. One way that we see this could be effective from administering this program is to make those credits available. They become available January 1st is how we administer the program currently. Come July 1st, any credits that are not used for the carve-out, making those available statewide. So you're essentially developing two times during the year when those credits would become available to investors. It's just one idea to share as we administer this program every day and see that as an opportunity.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I understand, I mean, when you say it's the only program DEED has for early stage, the simple response to that would be, and it's not meant as being sarcastic, but well, why don't we try other programs? But I recognize the difficulty in hitting these early stage companies. And I know this is different phase in R&D for U of M and other things, but bottom line is it says it's not paying back. It's hugely regressive tax policy. I guess I wonder, I mean, you say it's the only program available, and I'm sure you're looking at other states. I mean, nobody has anything better than this to help the early stage folks.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, our team has looked at what programs other states have, and many states have stronger programs, meaning more funding available for early stage startups than what we have here in Minnesota. We do provide technical assistance to startup companies, to small businesses. Through our business competitive grant, we provide money to organizations like MITA, Women Venture, that are supporting minority and women-owned businesses through technical assistance. But the Angel Tax Credit Program is our one way of getting funding to very early stage companies at a point that in the business life cycle, it's actually referred to as the valley of death is the term that's from idea and concept through that product development phase before you actually get your product to market. So this is a very critical stage in business development and one way that we as a state can support our entrepreneurs.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Are there instances where you've had a shortfall of credits and not been able to help greater Minnesota or women-owned businesses?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, every year we have there's more activity in this program. The very first year it started, the credits lasted until November. This past year they ended in the first week of March. So every year there are companies that that apply that do not receive those credits, and I don't know specifically the numbers around greater Minnesota or women or minority-owned businesses, but my assumption is that there are businesses from greater Minnesota and women and minority in that group.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, no reason to believe that it's disproportionate to women or greater Minnesota businesses.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, we do. Our talented team at DEED just gave me some information. So it is a reminder that this program is first come, first serve. So as companies apply, whether they're a metro-based, greater Minnesota-based, minority or women-owned right. business, first in the door has access to those credits.
Well, but Mr. Chair, my question is, there's no reason to believe that women or greater Minnesota businesses have been disproportionately denied access to these angel investment credits. And one of my concerns is we do have programs like JobZ that are set aside just for greater Minnesota, and folks in businesses, say, in Carver County don't get access to that tool. And so this is one tool that is available on a first-come, first-served basis. It's encouraged to, and it is intended to encourage the innovation, not the location, or to be a geographic program, but one that follows, as I said, the innovation. And I for one, would like to keep it that way. That first-come, first-serve seems fair enough to me if there hasn't been a disproportionate denial of access to some of these other businesses.
And Senator Artman, I'm sure your JobZ is expired now.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, yes. But it has had an impact or not in certain areas.
Right. Senator Reiner?
I'll just wait for closing comments.
Thank you. Senator Rest?
I forgot.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the clarification on Job Z. That's correct. One item to note that we were not tracking women and minority-owned businesses until 2012. We passed that legislation in 2012 that required that we look at our angel investment credits in regards to women and minority-owned businesses. So we don't have a very long track record of even being able to monitor that.
Thank you. Let's get our last testifier up. Ms. Boy, I'm not even going to try. Welcome to the Tax Committee, and please state your name for the
Thank you, Mr. Record. Chair, members of the committee, Genevieve Plumador with Life Science Alley. I know we've been before this committee before, but just as a reminder, we are the largest state-based organization of its kind representing the medical device clusters here in Minnesota, biotechnology industries, and biologics. Our members range from the Medtronics and the 3Ms of the world to the small early stage development companies that are trying to be the next 3M and Medtronic of the world. Life Science Alley asks for your continued support of the Angel Investment Tax Credit. This program has leveraged investment dollars into the state, as evidenced by the Department of Revenue report. Life Science Alley did their own report last year that has shown that in the last 5 years there actually has been growth in this area in comparison to some of the other states that we're in competition with for these types of industries. We liken that to be because of some tax programs, including the Angel Investment Tax Credit, that has brought some of that early stage development to the state. Life Science Alley is supportive of incentives to Greater Minnesota. We have no issue with that part of it. We can only speak to our own clusters. Our companies happen to cluster around Medtronic, Austin Scientific, St. Jude, along Medical Alley. That's where the talent is. That is where the engineers are. That is where the network is happening and the innovation is happening naturally. So no opposition to the Greater Minnesota piece, but liking the commissioner's suggestion of maybe opening up those credits statewide if they aren't used up by a certain time frame, because traditionally the credit has been used up and 10 to 11 million have gone to the metro area. Anything less than that would essentially be a cut to some of our med tech companies that have taken advantage, including the member that was here testifying earlier. So we thank you again for your time, and we again just ask for your continued support of the credit and appreciate the fact that the sunset has been extended in the bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been handed to me that the report does request that there is a set-aside for Greater Minnesota. They're talking about the conditions in Greater Minnesota requiring a longer time period, more difficulty connecting the investors.
What page is that on?
It's page 67. A set-aside would preserve a portion of the angel tax credit for businesses in Greater Minnesota. Now, I don't want to speculate what Senator Reinert was contemplating by the inclusion of the women and minority-owned businesses in this, but it seems to me that the people that were doing the report were actually taking a look at some of the access available to these funds and in their deliberations and bringing the report forward. So, this is a modest little step here, and, you know, we'll be back here again next year or the year following to see how the credit is doing, and, you know, maybe we'll undo changes or maybe we'll make other changes. But it seems like a pretty modest little step. Any other questions? Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think just one final comment. The whole discussion today has been about the value of tax credits. We've been talking about where that most value is, but I think we should not lose sight of the fact that tax credits or lower taxes incent economic growth. That's what we've been talking about today. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Arpin.
For the testifier, Ms. Plumador, did I say your name correctly? Did you just say that last testifier would not have had access to as much in terms of the angel investor credit if there had been a set-aside imposed in 2013?
Ms. Plumenhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman, what our position is at Life Science Alley is we've seen, and again, I can only speak to MedTech and our companies that have taken advantage of the credit, which has been about 30% of the total $15 million. Most of our companies have been in the metro. So looking at the credit, if traditionally 10 to 11 million have gone to the metro, 7.5 now would essentially be a cut to the pot on first come first serve basis for our companies and our types of members to get access to those funds.
Thank you.
Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 2503? Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Reiner opened his description of the bill by saying there was an amendment. Did we adopt that when I was out of the room? Or?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Amendment's been adopted. Okay, seeing no other questions and nobody else wishing to testify, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Senator Reinhart. We will lay Senate File 2503 as amended over for possible inclusion. Senator Rest.
Okay. Senator Skoy has three bills, on the agenda for this morning. Senator Skoy, what order do you want to take them in? So we have before us Senate File 2250. And I believe this bill has been other places. So what we have in front of us is the we have an engrossment following its path to the Finance Committee, and now it's here in the Tax Committee. Senator Skoy, 2250, and there is, members, a revenue note accompanying the bill. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this is, I'm here with Senate File 2205, a bill dealing with the state's budget reserve. And as the chair has accurately mentioned, this bill has been through the Finance Committee. The Finance Committee did a fair amount of work on the mechanism that is in this bill for determining what an adequate budget reserve would be. And then we had a continued discussion about the priorities that would be in the legislation with regards to when there are positive general fund dollars that they would be allocated and where the budget reserve would fall in that priority list. Let me just first start by going through just a real brief history of what we are dealing with here. In 1984, the first budget reserve was funded. It was $250 million. It was a combined reserve and cash flow account. In 1995, this was separated into two accounts. And by 1999, the reserves had increased to $622 million. They since have fluctuated from a low of zero to a high of $660 million for 2014. There have been a number of working groups and study commissions that have looked at the adequacy of Minnesota reserves and whether there would be a mechanism for having positive fund balances going, some of which would be going into the reserve. Latimer Commission in 1984 recommended a budget reserve as a permanent part of the state's fiscal structure. 1986, the State Budget Stability Working Group recommended reserves that were based on the volatility of the revenue that was going into them. 1992, Carlson Commission talking about a cash flow account that should be maintained separately from the rainy day budget reserve, and that the rainy day budget reserve should be maintained to manage cyclical economic volatility. And then in 2009, the latest group was Governor Pawlenty's Budget Trend Study Commission. We recommended that the budget reserve be based on volatility of the revenue and as a percentage of the overall state general fund. And so what we have is Senate File 2250, which builds off of these years of study and recommendation. Senate File 2250 does recommend or require that we keep the cash flow account separate from the budget reserve. It does require that the commissioner of MMB do a study annually to take into account the volatility of our revenue and as a percentage of our general fund, make a recommendation as to the adequate level of budget reserves. And in the discussions that we have been having currently within the bill, that would be that we would have a 95% certainty of being able to withstand deficits that would be the size that we would occur once in every 20 years. And so hopefully this would be an adequate amount. And then the final component of Senate File 2250 is that currently we have four conditions that are met prior to money being falling to the bottom line or being considered positive. And that is that we have first of all, the cash flow account should be established at $350 million. Number two, that the budget reserve would be, and previously was $653 million. In Senate File 2250, we are raising that to $810 million. That the amount necessary to increase the aid payment for schools would be paid back. That's the school shift. And then the amount necessary to restore the property tax recognition shift should be met. And then after those four conditions are met, if there was positive fund balances after that, a third of them, 33%, would automatically go into the budget reserve. So when the forecast is given in November, if there are positive dollars to the general fund, a third of them, 33%, would go to the reserve and the rest would go for other legislative spending when the legislature is in session. And so I think that is a pretty quick overview of what Senate File 2250 does. And I don't have any testifiers, but I think questions.
Senator Scoy, I have a question. When the currently, when the forecast is made and absent the reserve fund and those other conditions you mentioned, there would be a, currently there would be like a $300 shortfall. Is that reported in the forecast as a shortfall or just a use of the reserves?
Could you say that again? I'm not.
Okay, so if we have $1 billion, we have $1 billion reserve, and the forecast comes out, and there's independent of the reserve, there would otherwise be a temporary shortfall for the next biennium of $300 million. Does that just automatically use $300 million out of the reserve to get to zero? How does the mechanism work? Not when we have an excess like we have this year, which you're proposing to use to build up the reserve even further. How is it balanced against a reserve when there is not a ongoing deficit, but a shortfall where we then have either the option of cutting spending, raising taxes or fees or whatever, or using the reserve?
And it's a very good question, and I will answer the shortfall first, and then I'll also talk after that about what happens when it's an amount over the dollar amount. My understanding is that when the forecast comes out, if the commissioner has recommended a percentage of the general fund that would equate to $1.5 billion reserve, and you're not at $1.5 billion and you're short money, nothing would happen to what's currently in the reserves. That would require legislative activity. And actually, other than this If you do have a positive general fund balance, you would have 33% amount that would go into the reserves. But if that doesn't get you to the recommended from the report, it doesn't make any changes. The legislature could add more or could not. And the other thing that we should be clear with regard to this budget number, it really is a target that we should be heading toward and the mechanism to try to get us there. But as Commissioner Showalter described it, as a shock absorber. And so as you're going along and you're having good times, the shock absorber would compress or go and add a little more into it. And when you have bad times, you would have the ability to take some out of it to manage the negative cash flows. But it does require legislative activity.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Scoia, I understand how it works relative to the forecast. So next February, we get a forecast. And if there's a surplus, a third of it goes to the budget reserve. What happens at the end of the biennium? How does this impact that? If at the end of the biennium, and all the books get reconciled by August or September, and there is some money left over at the end of the biennium that hasn't been expended, what happens to that money? It seems like if there's something there, a third of that should be picked up or more and put into the reserve. That's kind of another issue, but there generally is either a positive or a negative, I guess, at the end of the biennium.
So it's the amount of money that falls to the bottom line one way or the other.
Correct.
How does your bill affect that? Senator Scoia?
And Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I've been working with the finance folks on this because some of this is in their jurisdictional area. So Mr. Nauman has joined me, and perhaps I can have him answer some of these questions.
So, Madam Chair,
Mr. Nauman, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Eric Nauman on the Senate Fiscal Staff. It's a pleasure to be back in front of you. It's been a while. The bill itself does not affect that calculation. Under current law, Madam Chair, the amount that's left over at the end of the buy-in would be booked as carry forward and would then turn into a revenue carry forward into the next biennium. That's how we traditionally do it. Of course, last year we not withstood that process and used that money to buy back K-12 shifts, but that was an unusual circumstance.
So, Madam Chair, how is that carry forward reflected in the November forecast after the end of the biennium?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, it would be reflected as revenue. It would be up in the revenue calculations as carry forward from the previous biennium.
So,
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nauman, there is no mechanism if there's a fund balance at the end of the biennium to put any of that money into the reserve in the bill right now as we see it.
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, no.
Senator Reinert, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I just, for Senator Scoia, on the airport fund on lines 2, 18, 19, and 20, and maybe you touched on this and I missed it, but we've replenished that, and so is that the purpose of taking that out?
Senator Reinert, yes. That was done, so this is obsolete language.
That was my thought. Thank you.
Yes, that's
being stricken.
That's an obsolete part of law.
Any other questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoia, if you had to pick an ideal reserve in terms of being responsible for the state, what dollar amount would you pick, the 810, or would you, obviously you're putting one-third more into it, would you say?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, as the bill was introduced, we tried to follow the recommendations of the Budget Trends Study Committee, and the recommendation, if you were to track with them, was $1.9 billion. And so we didn't think that was exactly doable. It doesn't mean that it shouldn't be something we should strive for. And so hence the mechanism that will hopefully over time get us there.
Senator Martin.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoia, so it's about double this would be what the recommendation was. When you factor in, as the state has used all these other banking accounts, in effect. I mean, we've used other funds, the school shift and other things. We've used them as in lieu of reserve. I can't remember where it was that the recommendations were. Did that include those things? It says we're using them if we don't have that big of a reserve. The hope would be if we have $1.9 billion, we wouldn't be robbing from other pots in order to balance things.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, those mechanisms are still in place. And as we started our budget reserve discussion, we actually considered adding a fifth priority, which would be the budget reserve. But we took the mechanism out of this and made it separate. And so that those four priorities are still in place and still usable. You did bring up the shifts that we have used in the past and currently are using. We actually have a shift bill that's around somewhere that might actually get a chance to that kind of goes through all the shifts that have occurred during the last number of years where we have used mechanisms such as this to balance our budgets.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just one final point. I think you're headed the right direction. I think it makes more sense to have the reasonable reserve rather than raiding these funds. From our perspective, it seems to work the same, but it's not really fair to the folks where we're raiding the funds. So I'm glad you're moving this way.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think it does anything to address the insatiable need for some around here to continue to spend taxpayer dollars. I just don't think that it really addresses the problem. It's probably a good idea to have a reserve, but my experience over the last 12 years has been every time there's been a surplus, Democrats here at the Capitol have wanted to spend every dime and then some. So I think there's more to this problem than just having a goal for a reserve.
Any further discussion or questions? Senator Bach?
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Nauman can tell me how many times in the last 12 years we've had a surplus. I remember one in, I think, fiscal year 2007 or 8, there was a one-time amount of money, but it seems like we haven't had a structurally balanced budget with a surplus since like 1999, if I'm right, but maybe Mr. Nauman can correct me. So I think it's a little unfair to say Democrats have spent the money the last 12 years when there was some.
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, your memory is pretty good. Of course, for fiscal staff, it becomes a question of what you're actually counting when you make that description. I think that 2007, 2008 had all 2008 also had a small surplus. I can't recall if it occurred in both. I can research it and get you the data definitively. We have it posted on the Senate website already. I think that the reference to 1999 was the last occasion when the surplus was projected to be as large as the one as this one. You have to go back to that. I think it was the February 99 forecast to have a reserve larger than the one that we have now. But we can certainly provide that to you, and that would take just a few minutes.
Hey, any other questions or comments? Then seeing none,
we'll... Chair.
Senator Sinjin.
I'm not sure if it's substantive or not, but I'll offer them anyway. It seems to me maybe I tag on a little bit with Senator Ortman. The reserve is there for a rainy day, whatever that day might be. But I think we also have to understand that the reserve is probably not something that we build the finances of state government around, and that state government has to ebb and flow in accordance with the economic prosperity that we either are enjoying or not enjoying within our economy. And so my point is, if the reserve gets too high, it tends to insulate state government from the realities of life in Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Sinjin. Senator Skoy.
Thank you. And members, for anybody who's been listening to what I've been saying this past session, one of the reasons that we are being a little more deliberative and thoughtful is that we want to make sure that we do not repeat some of the mistakes of the past, and that we want to not have to get ourselves in a situation where we have to rely on shifts and that sort of mechanisms to balance our budget again. I think that it's appropriate, as many businesses and organizations do is to carry a small percentage of your general fund needs in a reserve to help you get through the times when your revenues are under stress. And it just seems like it's kind of the fiscally responsible thing to do. People have different takes on that, but for what I've been saying, I think that it's a pretty conservative approach to fiscal management.
Okay, we will move on then, and Chair lays over Senate File 2250. The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 2230, Senator Skoy, Cities Local Government Aid, Payment in Lieu of Taxes Distribution Modifications, Calculation of Aid Losses Modifications, and 2230, there is a Department of Revenue revenue note, and et cetera.
Madam Chair, and this is a couple of issues that the department has brought to me that needs to be fixed to ensure that the calculations used for LGA and for payment in lieu of taxes match what the intent of the conference committee were. The first part in Section 1 is a minimal change to the LGA formula so that that the cities that were intended to receive their payments in the actually receive what we intended them. It's a small shift within the LGA formula between communities. Section 2 is a payment in lieu of taxes. Currently, 10% of the payment in lieu goes to townships. Without this change in law, it could be interpreted that if there were 10 townships in a county, those 10 townships would receive the entire payment. That's not what we intended. So these are relatively technical things that need to move forward to ensure what we intend occur.
Any questions for Senator Skoy on 2230? Is there anyone? I should have asked this about the other bill as well. Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 2230? Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Senator Skoy, I just have a quick question. Could you describe the difference between certified aid and formula aid?
Senator Skoy. And are you pointing to a particular line in the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Line 1.14, we're striking certified aid and we're replacing it with formula aid. I'd just like to know what the difference is between those two.
I'm going to refer to Mr. Sylvia on that.
Mr. Sylvia, did we have a change in language with regard to the new formula from last year? I do see that on line 110, we do mention certified aid, so that title or that reference is not going away. It's just not being used in line 114, Senator Nelson. But Mr. Sylvia, would you explain that those first 10 lines or so of the bill?
Madam Chair, if I could actually defer to Mr. Paulson, who's at the table.
Uh-huh. Mr. Paulson. Paulson, sure. Mr. Paulson.
Madam Chair, the certified aid is actually the final amount that is certified by the department at the end of the entire process with the minimum, maximum, all those sorts of things. The formula aid is the need that's calculated under the formula. So,
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there a difference between the two? Is there ever a difference between what the certified aid is and the formula aid?
Mr. Paulson.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, yes. For 2014, the aid was not allowed to go below the 2013 amount. And so in that case, there was a difference.
Senator Nelson.
So why do we want to do this change today? What's the impetus for making this change today from certified to formula aid, and how would it impact going forward?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, one of the things that happened is that some of the groups that are interested in LGA were looking at increasing the appropriation, and they found that the more the appropriation was increased, certain cities were losing aid under the formula, and we went back and looked at what was going on, and we discovered that the language for 2015 and going forward was not correct the way that it had been intended when it was passed.
So, Senator Nelson. So just one final question then. Do we need to see a run how this is going to affect individual cities going from certified aid to formula aid? Is it going to make a difference?
Well, Senator Nelson, if you, for one thing, it doesn't make any difference in the money going out from the state. No, that money is not changed. It's the allocation within it to start with. But then, Mr. Paulson, to her point.
Madam Chair, we could do that. We could take a look at what the differences would be, yes.
Yes, I'd like to see that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sir.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Nelson. Yeah, we can get you that. I think there's one around somewhere. There's a 10 or 12 cities that receive a small increase, but mostly it's so that going forward, if there's changes in LGA, that we don't have this uncertainty about what level that those communities are going to be achieving. And it's brought forward to us by the department and the cities that were analyzing the impacts of last year's LGA change.
Thank you.
So, Senator Shorey, if we're not increasing the amount and some cities are going to get more, that means some cities are going to get less.
It is. That's absolutely right. It's a relatively small amount of money, but that shift is occurring inside the LGA.
So it's internal. It's not an additional appropriation.
Thank you.
Which, in a sense, it corrects the formula that should have been there to start with. Is that accurate?
Well, I think when we were having the LGA formula discussion last year, this would bring us in line with what the intent of the discussion was. There was a language issue that the intent and the language didn't quite line up.
Is there anyone that wishes, Senator Nelson, anything further?
No, I'll just look for that information, Madam Chair.
We'll get that to you, Senator.
Thank you.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify in support of or in opposition to Senate File 2230?
Madam Chair?
Senator Sengel.
Perhaps that information go to the entire committee.
Sure.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 2230? Seeing none.
Madam Chair, just let me remind everybody when they look at that, the formula is a living formula, and the money moves around every year. So you may have a city that's a winner or a loser, and it may have little to do with what you see Senator Skoy's bill doing. The formula just moves around every year, depending on what's happening.
I think we do have a run that is related just to this. I think the department has prepared it, and we'll try to get it to the committee members.
Thank you.
Right. When something is formula-driven, you just can't say, well, you get more if the formula gives you more, and if you get less, well, then we're going to give you the same. I mean, we're trying to get away from the totally grandfathering, but this is not that issue. This is a formula issue. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 2230. The final bill on the agenda is Senate File 2388, dealing with conformity of Minnesota to the Internal Revenue Code. Senator Skoy, and in your packets, there is the Department of Revenue's extensive revenue estimate and a copy of the bill. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And we've had over the last year a number of hearings with regard to conformity. So while I'm going to ask Ms. McQuay to come forward and walk through the spreadsheet, I'm not going to go through a detailed analysis of all the provisions. They are spelled out on the Department of Revenue impact statement in front of you, other than to say that this bill is for full conformity except for Section 179. We dealt with Section 179 last year in the state's short-term history. I guess we used Section 179 as a 20% add back, which results in a five-year depreciation schedule. And the federal government has an accelerated depreciation schedule up to certain levels for Section 179. So that is not in this bill. Otherwise, this bill would be considered a full conformity bill with full retroactivity for 2013. As you look at the revenue note, the $157 million plus for 2014 and over $300 million in cost for the 2015-16 biennium, give you a little understanding of some of the calculations and some of the thoughts that we've been working on this year as we have been preparing the bill to line up with the proposals that the House has sent us with regard to conformity. And so I think with that, we'll have Ms. McQuay walk through the spreadsheet and then open it up for questions from members.
Ms. McQuay. Madam Chair and members, the revenue estimate is, if you flip to the second page, is organized into groups, and I'll just walk through each grouping and point out for you which ones are temporary provisions and which ones are ongoing. The first grouping for organizational purposes is that education-related provisions, and the first four provisions, the education savings account, the exclusion for employer-provided education assistance, the student loan deduction, and the exclusion for awards under the National Healthcare Service Corps are ongoing deductions or exclusions that are allowed by the federal government that we are conforming to. The deduction for educator expenses and the deduction for qualified tuition-related expenses is a conformity item for tax year 13 only that this bill conforms to. The next grouping of...
Ms. McQuay, the federal government currently, are they still actively considering extending the 2013-only provisions like the last two? Or is that still kind of in the mix at the federal level? As I recall, they sometimes have adopted these provisions on a year-by-year basis, and right at the end they scurry around and they end up adopting them. Or is the discussion there not related? Is there no discussion about continuing, like, for example, these last two that you're aware of?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware if there's any discussions ongoing right now at the federal level. However, I would say that this is a provision that's been, these two provisions have been seen in the, we did conform in the...
Every year we see them.
We do see them. We haven't always conformed, but we do see them on a regular basis. The next grouping would be the restricted deductions for high-income taxpayers. This would be the increase, the income thresholds for the limitation on itemized deductions, and increasing the income thresholds for the phase-out of the personal exemptions. I'll just add that those both are ongoing provisions that the federal government has enacted, and the state would to conform would have to conform ongoing. The marriage penalty relief has two associated provisions. The increase in the standard deduction for married filers is a ongoing conformity item beginning in tax year 13. The working family credit increase for the married joint filers by $5,000. This is the provision that we heard yesterday in Senator Rest and Senator Dietzick's bill. This is slightly different from federal conformity, although we've always grouped it here because it is aligning to federal conformity with that $5,000. And the four items that I would just mentioned, I'll also mention, are indexed for inflation. With the working family credit, that is for tax years 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, and then that $5,000 goes to an increase of $3,000 indexed for inflation.
And that would currently be, I think we saw yesterday, Ms. McQuay, at 5430. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. For tax year 14, it is 5,434. Tax year 13, it's 5,340.
And
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, Ms. McQuaid, and that's to keep us in conformity with the indexing that the federal government has done.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, that's correct. Our statute does link to that indexing. The next grouping is the home ownership provisions, and these two provisions are both tax year 13 provisions only. They are not ongoing, and they are the exclusion of discharge of indebtedness income on principal residence. This is commonly referred to as the foreclosure item to exclude the amount of the foreclosure difference between from income. And also the premiums for mortgage interest deductible as a qualified resident interest. The next grouping is that charitable contribution provision.
Excuse me, Ms. McQuaid, I have a question about that too. Are those two provisions ones that the federal government have also enacted on a year-by-year basis since the housing crisis? Do you know when they started doing that, and or was it specifically enacted only in year 2013, or was it there for 2012 as well?
Madam Chair and members, I believe it was originally enacted in the Mortgage Debt Relief Act of 2007. And I believe the one-year extension was in the ATRA, but we can Ms. Pollack will confirm that.
And has Minnesota ever allowed that?
Madam Chair, the premiums for allowing the filers to treat premiums paid as qualified resident interest was conformed in 2007 and 2011. I don't recall if the exclusion of discharge of indebtedness was conformed to, but we can.
I just think it's interesting to have what Minnesota's history has been with regard to some of these provisions that are in the federal law are just a one-year provision as well, rather than an ongoing and permanent adjustment, so that we understand what those are. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the next grouping is the charitable contribution provisions, and these are often special rules for qualified conservation property, IRA distributions. There's an enhanced charitable deduction for corporations. This is a provision that was originally allowed to C-Corps that was extended to S-Corps. And then there's a basis adjustment for charitable contributions of property. Those four provisions were enacted by the federal government for tax year 13 only. Then there's three other provisions that just affect individuals and not corporations, and that would be the dependent care credit. This is the increase, the eligibility, expense limit, and the credit rate, the exclusion for employer-provided adoption assistance, and the parity exclusion for exclusion of the employer-provided mass transit. The first two provisions, the dependent care and the adoption assistance, are ongoing provisions, and the transit provision is a tax year 13 provision only. Then the next two pages of federal conformity items are the business and investment provisions, and these are all for tax year 13. And I will just point out that I'll just point out the provisions that also affect the individual income tax, and then the rest are corporate franchise tax, or they're listed here as well. The 15-year straight line depreciation affects both the individual income tax and the corporate. The accelerated depreciation for business property on Indian reservations, the special expensing rules for certain film and television productions, are the three that affect the individual income tax as well as the corporate. Madam Chair, that concludes the federal conformity provisions.
Senator Skoy, further comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question to Ms. McClay. With regard to the restricted deductions for high income, we are phasing out at a higher level if we were to conform with this. Can you give me a feel for what levels of income increase would be impacted?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, for tax year 13, the federal phase out for the phase out of the personal and dependent exemptions begins at $300,000, and the state begins at without conformity at $267,200. The limitation on itemized deductions, the phase out for married joint filers at the federal level is again $300,000, and the state is $178,150.
Ms. McQuaid, did the phase out at the federal level come about because of indexing? That increase?
Madam Chair, I believe there was an increase to it, but it is also indexed.
Curious. Discussion or questions on Senate File 2388. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Quay, for that walkthrough. There's a few items that I'm interested in that I didn't see on here. One has to do with the 10% gift tax that was enacted last year. The Wall Street Journal had an interesting article called The Die Harder States, and it said Minnesota's increased the incentive to move to Florida. I have some of those snowbirds in my district who go to Florida in the wintertime. And now because we've enacted that 10% gift tax with $1 million exemption, it's just incented them to fully stay in Florida instead of Minnesota. So now we're not getting any of their tax dollars. And I'm just wondering, is that addressed here?
Senator Nelson, it's not a conformity issue, but we did have a bill on that in the division. But Senator Skoy, you want to have further comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, that's what I was going to say. We do have a bill on that in the division. We are contemplating it. It's not, wouldn't be, I mean, well, I mean, it could be construed as a conformity. It's not on a list of the federal conformity issues that we traditionally would have dealt with in that manner. It is the estate and gift tax area. And so we're going to take a look at that as we move forward on this, but it's being dealt with in another bill.
Thank you. And one further question,
sure.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
This, I'm not sure if this is Section 179 that isn't covered, but you could tell me what's there. But I'm wondering about that estate tax, that $5 million exemption. Is that covered here or is that elsewhere?
Senator Nelson, that was in my bill where we had we established a unified system just like they have at the federal level. And we moved to a $5 million exemption, had Minnesota rates, got rid of the 41% federal bubble, and we repealed the small business exemption because we didn't need it if we moved to 5 million. So I think you'll see some of those provisions resurface at some point.
Thank you.
But it's not a conformity issue, although
it is.
I'll respond to that. If we did conform, we would keep the gift tax, and we would index the exemption. And I think that's one where the federal exemption is like at 5 million something or other. Now the bill we heard in the division did not index the exemption going forward, and part of the reason for that is the issue that it causes with regard to the rates that are applied.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe Ms. Pollack can help me on this, but my recollection of the testimony in the division was that because of the interactions with the state law and the federal government, just conforming to the federal state tax provisions with the gift tax does not get rid of the Minnesota bubble. And I believe that the only way we can get rid of the Minnesota bubble is to establish
rates.
Minnesota rates. But Ms. Pollack, is that accurate?
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy and Senator Nelson, yes, that's correct. By conforming Minnesota, the Minnesota estate exemption to the $5 million indexed for inflation. That would not get rid of the bubble issue. The bubble would just essentially grow larger in proportion to the increase between $1 million and $5
million. Senator Ordman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, and I think Senator Nelson is right to ask about related issues. Are you expecting there to be one tax bill, or are you expecting that there's going to be a second tax bill? I understand we have one on a fast track, according to what Governor Dayton is saying, and so I'm wondering, what are the intentions? Are we going to mark up one big omnibus bill this week, or are we expecting a second bill?
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Ortman. As you probably have been able to ascertain, the Senate is on a little different path than the House. The second bill would be dependent on whether the House send us over another tax bill or not. But we will have House File 1777 in committee tomorrow, and then we will work further on it on Thursday.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, I'm wondering if you know, or maybe the Department of Revenue can tell us what full federal conformity for 2013 would actually cost us?
Madam Chair, I think it's on the spreadsheet of $157,325,000.
Yeah, the revenue estimate is for full conformity for 2013 and the FY 2014 number.
So, Madam Chair, all elements, regardless of what's contained in Senate File 2388?
Yes.
So we're conforming to everything.
Well, this bill does.
This bill does.
That's what I wanted to
and
confirm.
Minus
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, minus the work that was done last year on Section 179 with the 20% add back.
And Madam Chair.
And it also doesn't, you know, the provisions that were in federal law for only 2013, we don't continue them in 2014 either.
Right. But, Madam Chair, then Senator Nelson's point is well taken, that we're not fully conforming to the relief from the estate tax.
The federal law hasn't changed, and Minnesota has always had its own.
Right.
So, in that regard, yes.
And Madam Chair,
which is why we have a bill to deal with it.
I think in order to get rid of the 41% bubble that we currently have with regard to Minnesota's estate tax, conforming with federal law does not get us there. We need to separate in order to get rid of the bubble.
Thank you.
I have two people that have asked to testify. Ms. Cadoon? From the Minnesota Chamber, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
Welcome
members
to
of
the
committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here to testify in support of Senator Skoy's bill, and I thank him for bringing it forward. We believe the ability to be able to comply with our tax laws without undue cost or complexity is obviously a very important goal. Federal conformity is an important component of that ability to be able to comply in order to reduce that complexity as well as reducing taxpayer confusion. The business provisions contained in the bill are fairly minimal on the overall cost, or it's approximately about $7 million that deal with business provisions. But the complexity of some of these are extreme if you do not comply with them, so we're very happy that you're included. Just one example would be it's not just 1 year of adjustment that you'd be dealing with for depreciation schedules. It could be up to 39 years of difference between the state and federal tax returns that businesses would have to keep records on and then adjust their taxes accordingly. So it's really important to be able to update to the federal code for those. There's also some very important employer-provided benefits that are included, such as adoption assistance, tuition reimbursement that are also included. I think it's important to comply to those as well, not only for the employee to get that benefit, it's also confusion for them when we do not comply because they're expecting a tax-free benefit. Many of those individuals were very surprised to learn that they would have to pay taxes in Minnesota because we did not address this last session. There was also additional cost for employers to, when we have kind of had that confusion this year when we did not comply to those. They had to adjust their systems, their HR systems, their forms, and that did have an administrative cost. So I appreciate bringing this forward. We do encourage an early tax bill still to be able to address these so taxpayers can know what their tax liabilities are and do not have to file amended returns, or at the least they can know what their estimated tax payment would be if they do have to delay their actual forms. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. And you do realize that if we had accepted the House's proposal last year for conformity, that was accompanied by a surcharge on every Minnesota taxpayer, and the Senate didn't think that that was the benefit was worth the cost there. So we didn't do that. But we're certainly taking it up this year. Thank you very much. Mr. Hamilton? If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ryan Hamilton, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. The Minnesota Realtors have a longstanding position in support of federal tax conformity and passing on tax relief adopted at the federal level on down to Minnesota taxpayers. So on behalf of the countless homeowners and home sellers that we represent, the Realtors thank Chair Skoy for including income tax relief for canceled mortgage debt and a deduction for mortgage insurance premiums. I'm going to quote some figures from our 2013 annual report on the Minnesota housing market. The average foreclosure price in 2013 was $122,000. The average short sales price in 2013 was $136,000. So I just wanted to give you those figures to show you the full breadth of the income levels and home ownership levels that income tax relief will impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to the bill? Are there further comments from members? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 2388. Senator Skoy, is there further announcements about the work of the committee for the rest of the week?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. On Wednesday, we have three bills, the Coonan biotank bill, result of work that was done this summer with regard to fermentation tanks. We have Senator Rest's unsession bill, the governor's unsession bill, and then we will be having an amendment to House File 1777.
Thank you very much, Senator Skoy, and we're meeting at 8:30.
And at 8:30, and then my expectation is we would continue member work on 1777 on Thursday.
Thank you very thank you, Senator Skoy. Mr. Hurd also informs me that we do have the run that Senator Nelson requested, and so it's being handed out now to members, so you can pick it up as you leave, or it's being distributed to you. And perhaps you can look it over. Maybe if tomorrow there are any questions, we could return to it.
Yes,
thank
you,
Madam Chair. Rather than sticking around now. Is that okay? Senator Skoy, is there further business? Then the committee stands adjourned.